Oscar, where's 1049 Park Avenue?
This is 1049 Park Avenue!
Can two divorced men share an apartment without driving each other crazy?
Hello, and welcome to 1049 Park Avenue. Ted Linhart, Garrett Eisler here. We have another interview today for you, and we're very excited to have this person on.
This one's a biggie. This is a biggie.
Yes, as Felix would say, it's a biggie. Maybe the biggest of the people who are breathing and eligible to get. We are so excited to welcome Heather Randall to our podcast. For those of you who don't know, and if you don't know, you probably shouldn't be listening. Heather was married to Tony from 1995 until he passed in 2004. And they had two children together. So welcome, Heather, to the podcast.
Thank you, Ted. Thank you, Garrett. You're reminding me of a story of a moment I had with Jack and Tony. We were all at a party. I feel like it was at Sardi's or something. And Jack looked around the room and he said, if we're the biggest people here, they got problems.
they bet they were at the time.
Well, they were the biggest people there at the party.
Yeah. I'll share. My dad used to have dinner with Lucille Ball at Sardi's when he worked with her on a Broadway show. All right. So let's quickly, we're going to just kind of cover how we got here with Heather today. And then we're going to talk not just about The Odd Couple. We're going to talk about Tony's entire life as Heather knows it better than anyone currently living and can share a lot of stories that she's heard. And of course, we'll spend a fair amount of time on The Odd Couple as well. And just so excited to have Heather here to share everything about Tony, since we love Tony, not just Felix. So I got an email three weeks ago now that just said, from Heather Randall, I've been listening to your podcast and let me know if you ever want to talk. And I did tell her, I don't really believe this is you.
Because of the known scam of Heather Randall in person.
Well, it just seemed too good to be true. That
it's melded from the Nigerian print story. Yeah. I need $5,000, Ted.
Oh, sorry. Yes. Garrett?
I've got it. It's being wired to you right now.
And she wrote back and said, well, I don't know who would imitate me, but it's me. So we spoke the next day. We even had lunch. And here we are. And Heather, why don't you quickly explain when you started listening, why you started listening to the podcast?
Yes. So I've been thinking about it, how I came upon you guys. And I'm pretty sure what had happened is someone told me Conan O'Brien was talking about Tony on his podcast. Ooh. So I went in the little search engine and put in Tony Randall, the shortcut, you know, the whole thing. And you guys came up.
Oh, wow.
And cool. I went, oh my God, I didn't even know this existed. And of course, it was a little harder to find because it's 1049 Park instead of The Odd Couple or whatever. So I listened to a couple of episodes and I went, oh my gosh, these guys know more about the show than Tony, Jack, and Gary combined. They'd probably go, oh wow, I had no idea that's what we were doing. So I listened to a few, I was really impressed. And that it wasn't, you know, gossipy or salacious, just an actual hard focus on the show, which I loved. And then I thought, should I reach out to them? And I thought, well, they're really, really kind of hard focused on the show. I don't know that they'd care about me. And then I got a call from a museum in Tulsa, Oklahoma that wants to do an exhibit about the famous people that have been there. So I went to my storage unit to get all my things out. And it just, you came up again on the library, on my library podcast. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to reach out to them.
Well, we're thrilled you made that decision. The reason it's not called The Odd Couple podcast is
when, good point, Ted.
When we were looking on what to call it, this isn't about me. When I was looking to see if there was an Odd Couple podcast before I ever decided to do one, there's like 20, but they're all about two guys who talk about sports. That's it. They're the odd couple, and somehow they're all sports.
Because sports fans tend to like the show because of Oscar. You know?
Yes.
I think that's not the answer. I think the answer is that two guys who talk about sports are odd and talk about different teams. So when we were coming up with the name for the podcast, I knew we couldn't call it The Odd Couple, and we actually came up with a couple names, and they were all taken. And then we just went with the obvious one because we didn't want to waste any more time. So that's why you found that way. So can you quickly tell our audience, just for those who don't know, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this, how you met Tony, so that we can get that just out of the way, because it's an interesting story.
Yes, and I have more than I told you the other day.
Oh, good.
So I was a student at NYU, and I saw a sign on the internship coordinator's office that the National Actors Theater was looking for interns. So I was studying theater, and I had been following that Tony Randall was starting this theater on Broadway, and he and Jack had done this benefit performance of The Odd Couple. And of course, I couldn't afford to go to that. And I thought, oh my God, I wish I was there. So I ran into the intern coordinator's office and I said, I want this job. I want this job. And I'm sure everyone's applying for it. And he said, you're the first one. And so I went there and interviewed with a production manager, and he was kind of talking to me like I was dumb. And I finally said to him, you know, I'm not as dumb as I look. And this man, whose name I can't even recall, told Tony that. And Tony told his wife, Florence, who was still alive at the time, about this girl that came in and said, you know, I'm not as dumb as I look. And Florence said, hire her. So in a strange way, nice. His first wife.
Right.
That's great.
Our meeting.
Right. Yeah.
And I did keep her. She was alive for about the first 6 months that I worked at the theater, and she was very, very ill.
Yeah. Yes.
And then the rest is history?
Yeah, there's more. Okay. So I worked there, and I'm very, very cheeky. I'm a very cheeky person. And so they were doing this read-through of the first play, which was The Crucible with Martin Sheen and Michael York. And so the non-actors are sitting on the fringes, and Tony sits down with a sandwich. And I said, can I have a bite? He said, no, but you can get me some coffee. And I was so crushed. I called my dad that night and I said, Dad, Tony Randall's not very nice. Said, well, honey, you're going to have to learn to work with all kinds of people. And by the second day, he was wonderful. And of course, he was incredibly nervous. This was a 10-year journey to get this theater open. So, you know, I was quite cheeky to say that.
By the way, Heather, just before we make sure, I want to get to this before we get so deep into Tony. Where are you from? What is your origin story?
I grew up, I was born in Richmond, Virginia. I grew up in Boca Raton, Florida. And I couldn't wait to get to New York, and I wanted to
You were a theater kid.
I was doing theater in Florida, you know, the children's theater and all that stuff, and the local university and all of those things. And then it was like, how do I move to New York and get my parents to pay for it? So NYU was it.
Sure.
And I loved it. I loved NYU. Yeah, yeah. I mean, being in the city when you're studying something like theater is so great. You meet all the greats and get to see lots of things.
And were you two together by the time you graduated?
No. I graduated that year. His wife passed away around that time, the summer of 92. And then the next year I was an actress in the company. I was in a play called Three Men on a Horse. It was Tony, Jack, Jerry Stiller, Danny Burstein was a young actor. As was Michael Stuhlbarg, Julie Haggerty. It was Ellen Green. It was a really, really fun time. It was as much fun as you could have.
Well, we'll be able to, I'd love to, when we get to National Actors Theater stuff, we can hear your first person, memories of that. Right, you did become you started as an intern, but then you were an actor in the company. So I look forward to talking about that. Ted, should we?
Yes, you go ahead, please. Please take it from here.
Yeah, I did want to make sure we talk about, you know, even though you obviously were not there with him, Tony's early life, because I think it's so little known about. And first of all, this is also for me an opportunity to just learn more about him, because there is no Tony Randall biography, as far as I can tell, at least a legitimate one. He didn't seem to, I don't know if he was interested in writing a memoir. I do have his book. About theatrical anecdotes.
Yes, which the reminds title of it, me.
Which reminds me. I enjoyed reading that a lot, and I was I was nicely surprised to see that it wasn't just theatrical anecdotes, that he does have some memories in it. He tells some anecdotes of his own experiences, especially as a young actor. So that's the closest he seems to have come to write a memoir. It just seems to me such a fascinating life. And I'm a theater scholar, and I'm also kind of a scholar of Jewish American culture. And my father, who was kind of the same age as Tony, actually, grew up in Brooklyn. But I know of the culture of Southern Jewish families, and the fact that Tony Randall created his own, in a way, persona as he became a professional actor. But I'm just so fascinated how he began as Leonard Rosenberg in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I'm just curious, like, what you learned, like, did he tell you stories about this? I'm curious to know about his parents, mm-hmm. about who his mother and father were and what they were like, and anything else about his family and those early childhood that he may have shared with you.
Sure. Well, he was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which really surprises people. I mean, he couldn't have been a more urbane New Yorker. But his father was Moishe Rosenberg. He was an art and antiques dealer. Mm-hmm. And they hit oil in Tulsa. And he said, well, there's going to be a lot of new millionaires that want to fit out their nice new homes with art and antiques. So I'm going to go down there and sell these things to them. And I think he did quite well. Tony grew up upper middle class and very comfortable. And what else can I say about that?
Tony was born in Tulsa, but his parents had moved there from the East.
I think his dad met his mother there because her brothers were in the oil business. We still have like 0.00088% of a little tiny property of some oil field. My son likes to say he's in small oil. It brings in a solid $300 a year. So anyway, Tony liked growing up in Tulsa, and I guess there was a thriving Jewish community there.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have much anti-Semitism in Tulsa. He had lived at a certain point of his life, I want to say from about 9 to 14, hold me to this, but they lived in Manhasset, New York, the North Shore of Long Island, and he encountered a lot of anti-Semitism there. Really bad, getting beaten up. Yeah. And his father was very religious. So sorry, I don't know the terms, but
the payas
and the I'm sorry. I'm a shiksa.
Yes, I know. Did he talk about them being Orthodox or
they were Orthodox and his father was kind of a religious zealot and he hated it. He absolutely hated it. And as a result, Tony was an atheist Jew his whole life.
Do you know why they moved?
Love the traditions. We still have mezuzahs around the house and all of that. But
do you know why they moved from Tulsa to Manhasset?
No.
Or you said that it was as if it was almost temporary. Like they went back east, and then if you said from like 9 to 14, but when he went to college,
I think his dad got pretty rich, and they built a really nice house in Manhasset and a house in Miami, and they went back and forth and up and down.
I see. Okay. I
remember him talking much about Miami, but then his parents divorced when he was 14. So his mother moved them back to Tulsa, where her family was, the oil men, and they supported the family. And then his dad passed away when he was 19. He did not have a good relationship at all with his father. He said his father really just rejected him.
Yeah.
But his mother worshiped the ground he walked on.
Very close to his mother,
Very. He said, you know, he'd come home from school and she'd have made a pie for him and she'd sit there and stare at him while he ate the pie. She just thought he was the greatest thing ever.
Yeah.
That's a little intense.
He had
confusing, right?
Yes.
He had a sister, right?
Edna.
Right.
Oh, of course. Yes.
Named the children on The Odd Couple, Leonard and Edna. Which was so moving to me when I first made that connection.
Did you ever meet Edna?
No, she passed before I ever met him. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd met her. I mean, he loved her very much.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's such a great, so many Americans in general, but I think a lot of Jewish Americans especially have this kind of reinvention reinventing their lives story, you know. And for Tony, it seems to have been going to Northwestern.
In yes.
The early 40s, he was he did some service in the armed services stateside, I think,
yes.
while he was in college.
No. So he must have gone to Northwestern when he was 18. I mean, Tony was brilliant. He honestly, truly the smartest human I ever met in my life. And he could talk about so many things, from art, opera, to baseball. He was a contributor to one of the dictionaries. They would poll him on the definitions and pronunciation of words. I mean, he was amazing. Anyway, sorry. So he was very smart. He went to Northwestern to study acting. He wanted to be an actor from the time he was very, very young. He saw John Barrymore, I guess, in a movie. He was obsessed with John Barrymore. He wanted to be John Barrymore. He went to Northwestern. And very, very early on, he met his wife, Florence. She was also a student there and was also from Oklahoma. Yeah. And fell madly in love with her, knew he was going to marry her the minute he looked at her. He spent a year there. And the professor said, you know, you're really talented. You should go to New York and you should study with Martha Graham and Sanford Meisner and go to acting school, go to conservatory. So he moved to New York with Florence. She really believed in him. She worked as a model, so she was able to make money to support them when he was struggling. And he got great training and really worked his entire career. I mean, yeah. I think he said he once had 10 weeks where he was out of work. And he
left Northwestern. He left after a year, right?
Left after a year, yes.
So we never, did he get a degree? Do you get a degree?
No, but he got an honorary doctorate in 2002.
Oh.
And it was one of the proudest days of his life. I was kind of surprised that he cared that much because he doesn't normally care about accolades, but he was really, really proud.
That's great.
Yeah.
And then he started.
You know, the Northwestern connection, Gary Marshall went there.
Right.
Gary's kids went there. Right. My daughter went there.
Ted Linhart went there.
Yes.
I went there.
Ted is a Northwestern.
Yes, alum. I'm a Northwestern alum. Yes.
I didn't apply to Northwestern because they required 2 years of calculus. So I just threw that application right out.
I did well in school. I don't remember that, but okay. Doesn't matter.
But Northwestern was one of the lead, if you wanted to study the theater, that was a hot, that there weren't many undergraduate theater programs. And that was, there was like Carnegie, what was known as Carnegie Tech then.
Which Chuck Lippman went to.
Oh, right. You know that's true. Yes. I read his memoir. Yes.
And so Jack. Yeah. Do you know why he went? Because he grew up in South Philly and he was in so much trouble with the bookies in South Philly. He had to go hide. So he went to college.
Right. That would have made a great Odd Couple episode for Oscar. Yes. So that's true. They both went to the leading, you know, whether wittingly or unwittingly, the leading drama schools of their time, even if Tony was just there a year. And I believe he got, now when at some point he was drafted into the service and he did, but he was in the Signal Corps, did radio involve? That's when he started doing radio or?
Yes. So he graduated, it must've been about 1940, 41. Yeah. His best friend at Neighborhood Playhouse was Eli Wallach. They met on the first day and they stayed very close friends to the very, very end. Mm. And that's fun. And getting to know people like that was extraordinary. So he worked immediately because back in those days, actors could get a lot of work in radio, doing radio dramas. So he would run job to job to job. And I don't think it paid a lot, but it paid enough that you could put it together and make a living.
Yeah.
Then he wasn't getting very far, but then he got cast in The Skin of Our Teeth, the original
Skin of Our Teeth. Wow.
Yes, with Tallulah Bankhead and Montgomery Clift. And
directed by Elia Kazam.
Oh, Elia Kazam. Yes, 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 yes. So, sorry, people are texting me. It's very annoying. Had one day of rehearsal, and on the second day, he got his draft notice.
Oh, so he didn't end up in the show. Yeah.
No, and he's nowhere in the
right
or anything. So then he was in the military for 4 years, And as what Eli Wallach was in the military for 6 years. I mean, they all were, right? They all had livestock. But they sent him to Washington, D.C. And he always said he was just a messenger boy for the Signal Corps. But I don't believe that.
You think he was a spy or something?
I want to think he was a code breaker because he wouldn't be smart enough.
Yes. Right.
No, he'd have been a terrible spy.
True. Yeah. And if I can, I know we're going to segue into his early television and film career, but I just want to say, like, in the theater, I know that from, he missed out on that one great opportunity in Skin of Our Teeth, but he then made his Broadway debut officially with Catherine Cornell, I think. Oh no, he made his Broadway debut in a weird production of a German play called The Chalk Circle.
Yes.
Which is, or a translation of the Chinese play, Chalk Circle, which is not to be confused with Brecht's later Chalk Circle play. But it is an interesting production of that, very rare production of that play.
Yes, it was Erwin Piscator.
He was
actually an inspiration to Brecht.
Right. So
there's actually someone that came before Brecht. And it was, he talked about it, I can't remember specifics, but he talked about it as a very, very proud moment in his career that he got to work with this great, great German.
Yeah, Piscator was the head of the New School theater program then, which was very influential on young actors at that time, including Brando. And then he went with Catherine Cornell. He was in a Catherine Cornell production.
He was in several productions.
Yeah. She had kind of a repertory company. Yeah.
Yes. And one of them was Antony and Cleopatra. And in that show was Tony, Eli Wallach, Ann Jackson, Maureen Stapleton, and Charlton Heston.
Another Northwestern. Did he go to Northwestern?
He went to Northwestern?
Yeah, I think he yes.
Yeah. I'm surprised Tony didn't mention because they might have been there around the same time. I'll go, I guess, maybe because he left early.
Well, I think this wouldn't be a big leap. To say that Tony did not like
it. I do not agree with Mr. Heston's politics now.
Definitely on the opposite ends of politics.
Yeah. So that's what a great cast there. And aside from, I'm sure, a few others in between, I mean, his big Broadway role, as I know it, was in Inherit the Wind, playing the reporter character, which is a major supporting part in that show. And I know people who saw him in it and well, my father, that's where my father knew him from, because my father was involved on Broadway around that time. And every time we saw the movie, he said, Tony Randall played that part in the
stage. Oh, right. It was that, Gene Kelly in the movie. And I think Tony was very sad.
Must have been a little miffed about that. Yeah.
Now, this was before or after Mr. Peepers?
This was at the, so it all happened around the same time. Now, Tony always said he never booked a job through an audition. And I know a lot of actors like that. Some people are good at auditioning. Some people are good actors, you know, and they're not necessarily the same thing. So, and apparently Marlon Brando couldn't audition. His agent sent, I think someone wanted to audition him. And the agent said, all you're going to find out is that he's a really bad auditioner. So just go work with the guy and then you'll find out. And I think Brando is dyslexic, which is, I think, why he was also a bad auditioner. Anyway, you have to keep me on point, you guys. I could go.
Sorry, Ted's watching the clock, right?
Anyway, so he got all these little jobs and little jobs and little jobs. And then directors and producers would see how good he was and bring him back for this and that and the other thing. And then he got Mr. Peepers. It was just a guest star role, 1 week. And they liked him so much, they brought him back and brought him back. And then I think by the next season, he was the co-star with Wally Cox. And I think that's when he got Inherit the Wind. And all of a sudden, now he was a star. He had a TV show and a Broadway show, and they were both hits.
And they were both, that was when I'm sure Peepers was in New York.
Yes.
Then.
I'm curious if he talked about New York at that era. Did he ever comment about what it was to live in New York in that time?
Well, he always lived in New York. He never lived anywhere else. Even when he was at the top of his career in Hollywood, he lived in a bungalow at the Chateau Marmont, as one does.
Yes.
And he refused to buy a home there. He said, it's a great place to work, but not to live. So he was died in the wool New Yorker. He rarely left the city. He couldn't go to the country because his allergies would act up, just like Felix.
So there you go. There's one. Yeah, I always denied being Felix, but I'm sure identify a few things.
Every story I've heard from Heather since the 3 weeks of knowing her is like, oh, well, that's Felix. That's Felix. and same about Jack. Every Jack story you have is Oscar.
Yeah.
There's obviously a big piece of them in those characters, but Tony was not nearly that controlling or out of control.
Yeah, right. For the comedy element, I guess you have to have some exaggeration.
By the way, while we mentioned Peepers, it just reminds me how one of the cameos in The Odd Couple that Ted and I really found very special was when Wally Cox, I was surprised in an episode that I thought I knew very well. Mm. All of a sudden, which has been the experience of this podcast, is like I just knew them from memory, but I never looked up who were these actors and everything. And I remember this funny little guy makes an appearance in a scene, and I was just shocked that, oh my God, that's Wally Cox in 1973 or something.
Yeah,
like almost 20 years after Peepers, and it was one of the last things Wally Cox did. Apparently,
he died very soon after that.
Yeah, and Tony doesn't even have the scene with him in the show. He's in one scene. And but I think the subject of our last interview, Eleanor Donoghue, even testified how she remembered that day of him being on the set and Tony being very happy to have Wally on the set. But it was probably also, I think, I don't think Wally was doing well at the end of his life, and so he got him that part. Yeah, so yeah. It sounds like they were close. They were friends for a long
time. I know
Tony worshipped him. I mean, he thought the world of him, but I can't remember. I know Tony said he really didn't want to be a star or an actor. Mm. It just sort of happened to him.
But Tony, not Wally. You're not talking about Tony, you're talking about Wally Cox. Yeah. I know, Heather, you're catching up on watching the episodes, and we highly recommend The Pen Is Mightier, that episode with Wally Cox in it. I don't know if you've seen it yet. The Pen Is Mightier.
Is that the one where he thinks he's a writer?
Yes. He tries to be a writer. Yeah. He tries to be a writer. Yes.
Yes.
I watched it just recently, and the scene with Wally Cox where he's reading a very sexually graphic novel that he's written and he tells it as it happened is very funny. And then he did a lot of live New York, right? A lot of live TV in New York during Once Inherit the Wind ended.
Yes. And also the TV industry was in New York at that time.
Yeah, right. Yep.
All of everyone. It.
Yes.
So he could work on Mr. Peepers during the day and run to the theater at night. And yes, he did many of those live Playhouse dramas.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tell you much about them, honestly.
You said something I just realized. So when he was filming The Odd Couple, he was living in a bungalow in Chateau Marmont. That's what he did. I never thought about that. I just assumed he'd moved there, but he
no, didn't. It's you know, as we've documented, yeah, it's hard to tell exactly, but they seem to go out and they filmed the season like summer and fall. So there was certainly, did not have to be there year round.
But that's still for 6 months to rent a hotel versus buying a real estate.
I wouldn't want to live that way. That'd be nice. As long as the network is putting me up, I would do that.
Oh, I guess they're paying for it. I didn't think about the fact they're paying for it. But are they paying?
Have spent that kind of money. No.
Okay.
No. The Paramount paid for it.
Oh, okay, all right.
I tell actors now about that, actor friends, they go, oh my God, that would never happen now.
That's what I was thinking. Right. I was thinking studios don't pay.
Yeah, he must have had it in his contract.
For rare circumstances for housing.
And remember, like when The Odd Couple began, when the show began, Tony was in the studio's mind, I think the star. He was a much more well-known actor than Klugman. So I imagine he was able to get that in his contract.
Yes. Do we want to segue into that part of his story?
Yes. The
Well, let's talk about the movies, definitely.
Yeah, well, successful. Sorry. Yes. Yeah, so let's get to the Rock Hunter and the Doris Day Rock Hudson movies. What you know about those?
I know that he was in a play on Broadway called Oh Men, Oh Women. He was
Garrett, do you know it?
I've known that title. But I don't.
Franco Tone.
Oh, wow. I know him from Twilight Zone, Franchot Tone. That's all I know him from.
I knew him from the group theater. Garrett must know.
Yes.
The theater.
Yep.
Done our theater studies. So he was in the Broadway. He was a replacement in that. And then somehow, because of that, he got cast in the film. He made his first movie at 40, which is pretty, you know, for all the aspiring actors out there, give them hope. So, and it was with David Niven, and he was terrified. It was filmed in New York, and he was terrified. And he said David Niven just took him under arm, and he was immediately comfortable, and he loved David Niven. I think from that, he got a contract with 20th Century. So that was, he was right at the end of the studio system. So he was put under contract. And then I don't know the order, but I feel like Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter came very quickly after he was under contract. And he said for 6 weeks, he was the hottest guy in Hollywood.
And then what happened in the seventh week?
Well, I think then he did the Doris Day Rock Hudson movies. And, you know, he was paired with every blonde movie.
Yes. What's with that? Right.
Jay Mansfield. And I said, were you attracted to them? He said, no, they were too tough. They were all tough. I wasn't attracted to them.
And he was married, obviously.
And he was married. Yeah. But, you know, one could still be attracted to Marilyn Monroe.
One could be, yes.
So I'm gonna interject something I discovered here, because I don't remember why I did this, but I watched an Alfred Hitchcock Hour with Tony Randall and Jane Mansfield. I had never known that she, what I would consider at that time, synced to TV, because that's what TV was thought of. And in this episode, I sent the video both to Garrett and Heather. He smokes. Now, Heather points out he does not inhale, which I did not notice that. But I was fascinated not only to see that they were reunited after Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, but then in the only thing I've ever seen him smoke in. Have you ever seen him with a cigarette in his mouth before, Heather?
No. That was definitely one of the first times I've ever seen that. There's the funny scene on the Carson show where Johnny was smoking and Tony makes a big scene out waving.
Yeah. Right. And then, so the Rock Hunter Doris Day, that was a big deal at the time, right?
Oh, Rock Hudson and Doris Day, yes.
Yeah, in those movies.
Oh, yes. And so they made three movies together, and it was Pillow Talk, Send Me No Flowers, Lover Come Back. And he had the time of his life doing those movies. He thought Doris Day was the most talented actress he ever worked with. He was amazed by her. She was very professional and very sweet. And I remember him speaking to her on the phone a few times, you know, when I was with him. And he loved Rock Hudson. He said he was just one of the guys. He'd get there early and play basketball with the crew. And he was just like, where was he? Was he from Oklahoma?
Something like that.
I think so. He was just like a nice farm boy.
Yeah, he was another invented character.
He was from, he was born in Winnetka, Illinois.
Okay.
His name was Ray. Didn't his friends, was it Ray?
Roy Harold Scherer Jr.
His friends called him Roy, right?
And just go on the topic. So I know that Tony became very involved in early on in the AIDS epidemic. So the fact that Rock Hudson became the first person to make, you know, AIDS tangible to people, how did he relate with that? Like, was he
I don't think he related it a lot. I mean, the only thing Tony ever said was that he didn't know Rock was gay. There were always girls around. There were always, you know, fans going crazy for him. And he was always very nice to them and all that kind of thing. But, you know, if he had a secret life, he didn't know. And I don't think Doris Day knew.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
About, you know, one more thing about those movies. I know it's jumping ahead a bit, but one of the most delightful roles that Tony did toward the end of his career was the Down With Love movie, which was basically a tribute spoof of those movies. And that was so brilliant that they got him to do a kind of cameo in that movie. Yes. Were you around for that?
I was. I think he did it as a gas. They probably paid him pretty well. I think it was one or two days of work. And, you know, he could do that stuff like the back of his hand.
Yeah, right.
So he did it for the fun. And I remember David Hyde Pierce being there that day.
He was playing the Tony Randall role, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Did you ever see that, Ted?
No, I didn't. You know what? I did not know this movie existed until you just said it. Now I'm looking at it.
Yeah, we should talk about it sometime. Yeah.
I do it's not kind remember. Kind of
a tongue-in-cheek homage.
Yeah.
To the Doris Day.
Is it a good? Is it a good movie?
I think
it's not
so.
As good as it's Pillow entertaining. Talk.
No, it's no, fun. It's not.
Yeah. Fair enough.
It's certainly a fun movie, and it's one. It must be Tony's. Certainly, I think his last major motion picture appearance.
It might be the last one he did. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 2003 because he passed away in 2004, right? Mm. Yeah. And then the next big thing, I think, before The Odd Couple is Seven Faces of Dr. Lau.
Yes.
Which
Have you ever seen that? I have.
I've seen parts of it, and it just seems exhausting to be him in that movie. Yeah. Did he ever? I want to ask you a specific question. But is there anything to share about his remembrance of that film?
No, only that, I mean, he loved it. He loved being in it. He thought it was a great vehicle for him, you know, to really show off his acting chops because he plays, seven different people.
Different nationalities.
Right.
An Asian man, which you couldn't do now.
No, it's not quite a politically correct film now, but it is fascinating, yeah.
And he made a movie with Janet Leigh called Hello Down There, where they lived 40 feet under the sea.
I don't know that film.
He did a bunch of movies that have not, you know, lasted as much as the Hudson Day movies, but that are kind of interesting. I know TCM, every now and then, they do like a marathon of his movies. Heather, I gather you're aware of that. I hope you are. So I've caught up with some of these when TCM does that.
What's the name of that movie you just said?
Hello Down There.
All right. I'm going to have to look that up. I'm curious before we get to The Odd Couple, you obviously walked around with him or lived with him and saw people react to him for 9 years. Was 100% of fan reaction to him Felix, or did he ever get, I loved you in the Rock Hudson movies. I loved you in Dr. Lau, or was it all Felix?
It was almost all Odd Couple. And what most people said, and it was very touching, was thank you for all the laughter, which always kind of like really touched me when people said that. So if you ever see a famous person on the street,
who was funny on purpose.
Yes, right. I'm not sure I'd say that to the person on my shirt.
Yes, don't say that.
I'm wearing a Mariska Hargitay shirt.
I say, yeah.
But then the other thing people would say so often is it was two different ones. They'd walk up to him and they'd go, Aristophanes.
Yeah. Great. Okay. And was the other one?
Up and say, it's a well-known fact that Lincoln liked Manny.
Those
were the two. People said them all the time.
So just all password.
All password all the time.
You know, we did it when we talked about our favorite episodes. And I think we had a debate of like, what's the most famous thing from The Odd Couple? I think we thought we landed on when you assume you make an ass out of you and me. But I think it's pretty clear from talking to you. And the more I read that it is the password episode, that just seems to be the one at that. And if that's true, I mean, not if that's true, given that fact that you're saying, I think there's no doubt that that's what people stick with. All right, let's get into The Odd Couple if we're ready. Okay. So you want to share your story that you know about how The Odd Couple came to be. So why don't we just start with that? How they came to be in The Odd Couple. Well, Tony, and then your knowledge of the Jack.
Yes. So, I guess it was the late 60s. Tony was an art collector. He had a beautiful art collection. And he wanted to buy a Brock. Now, by the way, you could buy these things for a lot less money back then.
Yeah.
He wanted to buy a Brock. And his business manager said, oh, that's fine. What well-paying job are you going to take to pay for that? So he called his agent and said, get me a well-paying job. So he got him The Odd Couple in Las Vegas. His co-star was Mickey Rooney. Tony said he was a great Oscar, by the way. And he got paid like crazy money for the time. At that same time, Gary Marshall was developing the television show. And someone said, go see Tony Randall in Vegas. He's the best one we've seen. And so he went backstage. I think, I don't know exactly if he offered it to him right in that moment, but it all sort of went into negotiations really soon after that. Tony did not want to do it because at that time, he was a movie star, and it was a demotion to go to television.
Right.
And so without maybe even meaning to be, he was a really tough negotiator. It really needed to be worth his while. Mm. So as I'm sure a lot of people know, Tony and Jack owned a portion of the show. So syndication.
That's a good idea. Good idea.
Every actor's dream. Yeah. Apparently. So he got a really nice portion of the ownership. And then Jack was a Broadway star. He had done Gypsy. It's really funny. I got a lot of people excited about Jack because he was in Gypsy.
Right, right.
So he got a much smaller percentage of ownership of the show. But Jack got 3 Emmys and Tony only got 1. So
yeah, I guess maybe that's even. Did Tony ever, do you know if he ever lobbied for the show to be filmed in New York?
I don't think so. He did with Love, Sydney, but we could get to that later.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think it was a deal. Everybody else was LA based.
Right. And then, okay, anything more you want to share on that before we get on to other?
Well, by the way, we get to pick up on what we were saying about his living arrangements. So he was, do you know if his wife came with him to LA, or was, you know, were they apart a lot during that time?
No, she went everywhere with him.
Okay, great.
They were always together, but she was reclusive.
That's what he gives in the way he is, the impression I get from her from, I guess, well, I read Jack Klugman's memoir where he talks about Tony a lot, and he remembers Florence. And but even Tony would go, I remember we dug up, I don't know if you've gotten to this part in our podcast, Heather, but we went through some episodes after we finished all the Odd Couple episodes. We did a bunch of like epilogues or something where, and we did like just clips of Tony and Jack on TV, talk shows and stuff. And he does this one clip in a Carson show in the 70s, I think, where he asks about what's your marriage like? And he basically adds a gag and just to get laughs, portrays Florence as like someone who's not at all interested and what he does, doesn't want to see his shows. But it did kind of ring true that she, you know, she would like to sit at home, and they had very important, their time together was very important, which is why Tony stayed, you know, did what he needed to do, but, you know, wanted his home life.
I think mostly she just wasn't interested in the
show business,
celebrity showbiz aspect of things.
Right.
And I think she's a large reason why he had a long, steady career, because she really kept his feet on the ground. She just kind of wouldn't let him get overtaken with the Hollywoodness of things.
Yeah.
And they lived in New York, and they collected art and went to the opera. And he talks about her all the time on the Carson show, but people don't remember that.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, we found those clips. Yeah.
Yeah, those clips are hard to find. Maybe you don't know or don't want to share. Do you know, did they, any reason behind, you two had 2 children, they did not after 50 years. Was there any specific rationale? Were they just like, it's not fits our lifestyle?
She couldn't have children, they could. And I think it was a source of real heartbreak for them
that they
could. Yeah.
All right. So next, I think you wanted to share a story about the opening credits.
Oh, yes. I was telling Ted this when we had lunch. So first of all, I think it's the greatest opening of any TV show ever.
You know, it may just be because Ted and I have noticed that it's imitated so much.
Yes.
It's certainly one of the most famous.
It's right? used today. It's still used today for promos and things.
You mean people copy it?
Yeah, well, there is an episode of Billions where Paul Giamatti's father in the show tells him that someone is going to be rooming together, and he starts to hum the theme to tell him. There's an episode of The Neighborhood, which was the CBS show, where they recite
basically do their version of
the voiceover. The theme and the dialogue are used to connote two people who shouldn't be living together. So even in 2023-24, both of them, people know, like, it means something to someone. Like, you can just refer it and you get the joke.
It is just kind of in the cultural zeitgeist.
It is, yes.
And you hear people reference it all the time, and they may not even know necessarily what they're referencing. So the opening was the idea of Tony's agent, Abby Greshler. Abby Greshler was this fabled Hollywood agent. He put Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis together. Oh. And made all kinds of fascinating clients. And Tony was with Abby all of his career until Abby died. And I never met him because he died before. But anyway, he just had this idea. Who was the star of Dragnet?
Jack Webb.
Maybe Jack Webb was also his client. And he said, well, wouldn't it be funny if we kind of do an imitation of the Dragnet?
Oh, that's so interesting. I didn't know that. I don't remember you saying that part of it. Okay.
Yeah. And I know a lot of people know this, but the reason he's kicked out on November 13th is it's Gary Marshall's birthday. And he never wanted his children to forget his. I asked him once, I said, he said, it's my birthday. I want my kids to remember. And guess what? Every November 13th,
yeah, now we all know
something about Gary Marshall and his birthday. By the way, maybe we can start a campaign. I write to Google Doodle all the time and try to get November 13th as a Google thing.
Ooh.
Especially just celebrate Gary Marshall.
Yeah.
Greatest creator.
All right. Well, we've got some 200 or so listeners, regular listeners.
Everybody
here,
write.
So, yes. This could
be a great one. And you know, there's been people, as the years go on, people post every November 13th about happy Fourth.
Absolutely. Sunday. It is an official Twitter handle. I mean, hashtag.
And we posted an episode on November 13th, and we always see it come up. And then
but that's funny about Dragnet, because that is right. They got a guy to do on November 13th, do the kind of Dragnet voice. Yeah, that's why.
Yeah, that's a great tidbit. And then there's the guy in the opening credits who was a real person.
Right. So, you know, it seems like they filmed most of the opening credits around the Plaza Hotel, Grand Army Plaza. Mm-hmm. And the scene when Tony's walking down the street with his suitcases and he's so forlorn. And he's, you know, you remember he stops and he sits on the suitcase and a guy comes up to him. Well, that was a real person. That was a real human being. He didn't know he was in a shot. And he stopped and said to Tony, are you okay? And Tony said, get out of the scene. Get out of the scene. We're filming.
So, not that he recognized Tony
that's,
Randall.
Right. That's what I want to know is, did he think Tony Randall had a problem or just some guy in New York who was down on his luck?
You know, knowing New York, he probably had no idea it was Tony.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
It looks like a very young guy. I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you see him, you'd probably say, I can't be Tony Randall sitting there with suitcases. Now, you
want to know if that guy got paid anything.
Right, or knew he was in the show. Like this. Yeah. Did he ever know that he was memorialized every week and then every day? Now, you said that Tony did not like the actual theme. Is that correct?
Well, he hated the song, but I think it's because he heard it. Yeah. Everywhere he went, every time he went on a stage or a talk show, he just heard it over and over, and he was just like, I can't stand it.
I wonder if every iconic sitcom star has that same reaction, because they must go through that same thing. Yeah. Now, one thing that I shared with you, and I think you weren't, you know, you've shared that Tony, let's talk about the season one to season two change. That's my topic. So, you have shared that Tony and Jack both did not like the format of season one, and they lobbied, right, to get it to go to the live studio audience? Was it just Tony?
I can't speak for Jack, but Tony, he talked about it a few times, and I was telling Ted, it's so cute. He didn't watch himself in his movies or anything like that, but he would make me watch episodes of The Odd Couple with him, and he would laugh hysterically at them.
I love that.
And he always said, "We're not watching season one. Forget it."
Hey, that makes like us that makes us like right for all the people who don't like us or me for not liking season one.
Ted, you can now have quote, "We're not watching season one."
Yeah. Right,
Tony Randall.
There's no other proof
to justify your prejudice
that the season one dislike is correct. If the star of the show told his wife 40 years later, we're not watching season one. So, and can you share any more about specifically what irked him? Do you remember anything about why he said that?
I don't, it was just one camera and there was no studio audience. So I think just changing to the three camera studio audience format it just made the difference in the energy and the movement. Beyond that, I don't really know. We talk about, Gary had been on the Dick Van Dyke Show. He had been a writer on the Dick Van Dyke Show. Mm-hmm. Or a producer.
I don't know. I'll try to look it up while you continue.
Certainly a number of the Odd Couple teams, but the head writers have been with Dick Van Dyke.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure.
I think Gary did so many. That was one of the many shows he came up with. Yeah.
Yeah.
As a young writer. Yeah.
But was Dick Van Dyke before a studio audience?
I believe so.
He wrote, maybe
they had the same problem. I think they started one way and then they eventually definitely were.
He wrote 18 episodes. I'm not a big fan of that show. And I don't remember. And maybe whoever listens to this will write us and we'll comment on it the next one. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I believe they are because Seinfeld, when Seinfeld shot at Castle Rock on that lot, Rob Reiner, who owns Castle Rock, told them that that's where his father did Dick Van Dyke.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. His father being Carl Reiner. For anyone who doesn't know. Yes.
Sheldon.
Sheldon. Yeah. Oh, so that one, that one you've seen. One. Yeah, you know that one.
You know what I saw the other day? Okay, so I was being a good girl and preparing for the podcast. So I was in the nail salon yesterday and I was watching on my iPhone with my headphones in and I was laughing out loud. It was the scene with Myrna Werner.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Oh, my
yeah.
God. With
Gary Marshall. Playing. Yeah.
Turner. Yes.
And their other sister, right? That's the other.
I think that must have been. Yes. Right.
Yeah.
Myrna Werner.
And so why you were bringing up Dick Van Dyke and Gary Marshall regarding the change
because
in season
of the
two.
Three camera format. So Gary must have known that worked, and I don't know exactly how they decided to go over to that, but it seems to me it would have been Gary's vast knowledge of television and what works.
Okay, and they didn't necessarily lobby for it, but they were happy to switch to that.
Yes.
I do believe Dick Van Dyke was multicam. I'm looking out up here.
Yeah.
So I was telling Heather that there is this, if there's a debate in the Odd Couple community that looms over all, it is the people who don't like season one and the people who do. And now we know that the people who don't are correct. Okay, moving on. That's good to know. Thank you, Heather, for confirming that.
Think that Ryan Murphy should do this as his next season of Feud.
That would be great. I'd love to play those two guys. Yeah.
So Penny Marshall, you wanted to share some information about Tony's initial reaction to Penny and then his later reaction to Penny when she came by.
Well, Gary, do you guys know about Fogs? It's called Friend of Gary.
Oh, okay.
And Gary puts all of his friends and all of his family in everything he ever does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's very funny. And the other reason he does it, especially with not with his family, but with his friends, is it helps them get their health care from SAG.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it was a really, really kind thing he did. He would help people get their hours. But so he was always putting his family in things. And he said, my sister Penny is going to come in. Oscar secretary. And Tony said, Gary, you're always putting your family in nepotism. So he was reluctant with Penny. But when she started acting, he thought she was absolutely brilliant. Yeah.
I believe that Penny credits Tony with encouraging her that Penny developed the Myrna laugh is something she kind of improvised during one of her scenes in the first episode she did. And Tony was so hysterical when she did that that's encouraged her, like that should be part of the character.
Oh, I love that. I mean,
so that must have been when he realized that she was funny. Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't friends. They didn't Well, let me put it this way. As everyone knows, Tony was a virulent anti-smoker and Penny was a smoker.
Wow.
And so
That's
Tony would give her a break.
kind of
I
hard
mean,
to
you don't
get
really
together.
blame her. It's the early 70s. Give me a break.
Right. I'm sure more people than not smoked on that
I
set
mean, Jack,
or smoked somewhere
starting with Mr. Klugman.
or wanted to smoke.
But it sounds like with Gary, he kept up over the years.
Who, Tony?
Or you got to know
Oh,
Gary
yes.
Marshall. Yeah,
Oh,
right.
yes. Yes, very much.
And didn't
I'm
Gary
well.
put your daughter in a movie?
Yes. So he put my kids in as extras on a movie called Georgia Rule. And that's when they were really little. It was with Lindsay Lohan.
Yes, I vaguely remember it.
I could talk about that. But and then when Gary was doing New Year's Eve, he cast Julia as one of the teenagers in the kid scenes with Abby Breslin, Abigail Breslin, and Sarah Jessica Parker. So Julia was on that show for about a week. And I do have a really sweet story. She was underage, so I had to be on the set with her at all times. And at one point, it was the middle of the night, it was freezing cold. They were filming in a diner, and I just needed to run across the street. And Gary said, "It's fine, just go, whatever." And when I came back, they were sitting in the window at a coffee table, and Gary was giving her notes. And it was just the most heartwarming thing to see Tony's daughter sitting with Gary Marshall, working as an actor. And
She
he
made it. She had
was
made
well, so she's a fog.
She's a fog.
And and get you and Gary were
And that
very
would have
close.
been one of Gary's last movies, I think,
Yeah, I
if
think
not
he
his
did
last.
Mother's Day after that.
I
I'm not
see.
sure.
Right. It's one of the, he did that series of holiday films.
But I do want to talk about Gary because he's one of my favorite humans that I've ever met. And going back to that Georgia Rule film with Lindsay Lohan. So they were filming somewhere in the middle of, way, way, way out east in LA, northeast, whatever. It's horrible. It was 105 degrees. And the only, so there was a base camp and then there was the shooting location. And the only trailer allowed on the actual location was Gary's. And he very nicely let us go in there and sit in the air conditioning. And Lindsay was late, and she was late, and she was late. And no one ever got upset. Gary's assistant would just be calling her agent saying, we're ready for Lindsay whenever she can show up. And when she finally showed up, Gary was so nice to her. He would just take her in hand. And we went out to clubs with her just to kind of like create a bond. That's who he was. He was such a nice human being, a good person.
And that seems to have been a secret of his success, really. I mean, his longevity, his career, his that he was cons I hear this from other actors and colleagues that his nurturing nature really is. I mean, he was so successful when you consider when The Odd Couple was his first time as a showrunner, but then he went straight from that to Happy Days and then like basically five of the top shows of the 70s and then transitioned very successfully to movies. I think a lot of that goodwill had a lot to do with it.
They used to say Gary didn't direct a movie. He threw a movie. It's just like being at a party, on his sets.
It seems that it seems to be the reputation that just I don't think people ever think of him in any negative terms. So that's
Nothing.
right. And you were very close to him until he passed.
He was so wonderful to us, to me and the kids after Tony died, as was Jack. I lived in Malibu for a little while, and I actually rented there. I rented a house there because Jack lived there. And I thought, well, that'll be fun. This was after his death, about a year later. And Gary had a house there, and then I eventually bought a house there. And so I saw a fair amount of all of them out there.
That's
And they were
great.
so, I mean, Jack was great to my kids. He was just very gentle and sweet with them.
That's great to hear. And then so Tony's, you want to talk about Tony's has two favorite episodes. We've talked about one, and you want to share his thoughts or your thoughts on the two that he loved?
Absolutely. I've been doing a lot of research on Tony lately because I'd like to make a documentary about him. And
We'd like you to.
if people have points of view about it, I'd love to hear what people want to know about him. I don't want it to be about our marriage because that was such a small blip in the story of who he was. I mean, I know it was important.
Important to you, definitely.
It's gossip, and people can be very strange about it all. Right. So he was a great actor and a great American, and I mean that in the old-fashioned sense of it, not the current. He was a really, really fine person and had a great life story. So anyway, his two favorite episodes were Password and Fear of Flying. Password was because he was actually going on the real Password and he was having his wife help coach him, you know, help him out. And she was coming up with all these crazy clues that made no sense to the answer. So that's, he went on the set.
And they could see that became the show. Yeah.
And that became the show. Gary, I have an idea.
And the other?
Well, Fear of Flying is the one. I mean, he would just, I watched it with him several times and he would just slap his leg and laugh hysterically. I can't remember any specifics about that episode, about how it was made or anything that happened. It was just generally his very favorite.
I think the one I remember him talking about it was rightfully takes credit for one big joke toward the end where they're on the plane, he goes to the bathroom and then everyone else gets off and he comes out of the bathroom and he said that he came up with that gag that everyone would be gone. They're sitting alone.
I also love when they're sitting on the plane and he's freaking out and he says, look at the maintenance panel there.
Yes, yeah.
I can read lips. There's much. Yes. I fear there's much wrong with the fuselage.
I much fear there is something wrong with the fuselage, Frederick. I remember watching that when I was, 12. I could still vividly remember watching that. Yeah. And I couldn't catch my breath. I was laughing so hard. It was the first time I ever saw that episode. It's probably the moment in my life that endured me to this show. And it's why we're doing this now, is because that and the orange, when he couldn't rhyme orange in the pencil episode, that memory. So the fact that you're pointing that out and that he would laugh at it, that's what you're saying, right? He would watch that. And what I love is the fact that he's willing to laugh watching himself do something funny. There's some actors who they pretend to be humble or really humble. I can't watch myself be funny, but he could, apparently.
He could with The Odd Couple, but I never watched anything else of his with him.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Yeah, he was really proud of it.
You two, what, I'm going to go a little deep. Did you guys just mention or address the fact that Terry Garr is in that episode?
You know, when you wrote that in the notes, I went, oh, that's right. That was Terry Garr. I think he thought she was really funny.
Yeah.
I think what I love about, I'm not surprised that's his favorite episode, because not only is it great, but those moments that we just talked about are great moments of what Tony really brought to the character, which is this kind of manic energy. I mean, to me, I've said this before on the show, like, I think Tony's Felix Unger is one of the all-time great, certainly TV comic characters, if not just comic characters in general. And part of it is, when you compare the character to the play or to the movie, Odd Couple movie, there's the neatness, the fussiness, the proper manners and all that. But what Tony brought to the characters was like insane manic energy when it counted, like when the situation demanded it. And it's so clear that Tony had that in him, that was part of his toolkit as an actor, and that he went with that. And no one else, I think, would have brought that to that role. So that's what I love about his performance in the show.
I agree. Well, you know, he always said the key to comedy is it has to be a life or death situation.
Right. Right.
And it has to mean everything to you. And that's what makes it absurd. I'm not a comedian. And in fact, I would tell jokes. And then at the end of the joke, Tony would say, now, do you want to know the right way to tell that joke?
Oh, no. Did he say that in front of others?
Probably. I didn't care.
Did he think of himself as a comedian, like as an actor for that genre, especially? I mean, he does have some dramatic roles, especially in the television appearances he did. Mm-hmm. And as we'll talk about, I think the Love, Sydney pilot, in a way, is a dramatic role. But I'm just curious, like, did he think of himself as a comic actor?
He thought of
himself that was his specialty.
What he wanted to be was a great actor.
Yeah, period. No.
Didn't matter. So a great actor can do both comedy and drama.
Exactly. And well, except he would say, you know, certain people aren't funny. There are people.
And he was funny. So that's why he was funny. That's why his career went that way. I guess.
And he knew he was funny, right? He would. Okay. What I think that's most remarkable about his performance is there's a lot of iconic television characters. Carol Connors, All in the Family, William Shatner, Peter Falk. And yes, Columbo existed before that, but Tony took a role that already existed in a popular film and a popular play and made it completely his own. I would argue trumps everybody else. And that's a much smaller list on TV, if there's any that I can think of offhand. I guess maybe MASH, but still, he took a role that people already know somebody else for. And I don't think most people think of those people anymore, partially because the episodes are all the time, but he just made it his own. And that's.
And in a way that anyone doing the play today, you know,
right.
I think has that looming, has him
yes.
and Jack looming over that.
Yeah. And he was aware of this. Was he aware, do you think, of how I know people come up and thanked him, but did he realize he had an iconic television role? Did he know that? Or did he just think that was a job that paid off very well, not paid off money, but what was a successful career? But did he realize that it was such an iconic television role? Or did he he did. Okay.
Oh, yes. He knew who he was.
Okay. That's good. I like somebody self-aware.
I mean, I'm sure, you know, people would say things too, like, oh, you're a national treasure. He never refuted it.
Okay. That's good.
He had strong ego.
Okay. And again, that's the character we saw when Felix, you know, there's my crazy sense of humor again. I mean, he thought he was the funniest guy. So, sorry, did you want to say something, Heather, about those?
No.
Okay. So I know you shared with us something that he has said before, but we know Odd Couple, struggled in the ratings, never was really truly successful on that successful on TV, but he discussed with you why it stayed around.
Yes. So you did the research, I think, but there was an executive at, I guess it was ABC.
ABC, yes.
Yeah. Named Martin Starger. And every 13 weeks, they would cancel the show. And then every 13 weeks, Marty Starker would reinstate the show. And Tony said it was all because of Martin Starker that the show ran for 5 years. He just believed in it. But apparently again, Ted, you know more about this because it's your industry, but the ratings on the East Coast and the West Coast were great. And then everything in between was tough.
Right.
It's a very coastal show. I've actually just been doing some analysis on other things for my job. And HBO was that way very much in the 90s, where you'd have something like Sex and the City or Sopranos that do it incredibly well coastally. And then the middle of the country wasn't as strong. And there are known TV shows. Seinfeld started that way as well. Mm-hmm. And I guess that he liked, maybe the advertisers liked it as well. Because it maybe gave a certain demographic, which even though this early on in demographics playing a role, but I guess it's great to know that there was a champion of the show, and maybe also, I don't know if Tony addressed it, maybe that's why the show got a chance to actually have an actual ending episode. Most shows that last five seasons that don't do that well in their run, the network does not give them the benefit of saying, you can wrap up your show with an episode that concludes the story if you want to. And they got a chance to do that. So I wonder if Martin Starger was the reason they were able to do that. But I assume Tony never shared that level of.
I don't know the story, except, okay. Of course, famously, Tony won the Emmy Award that year after the show was canceled. And his speech was literally, thank you. Now I just wish I had a job. That's all he said.
And so let's talk about another topic you shared with me was, and we've talked about it, was ABC being worried that people would think they were gay.
Yes. So again, doing my homework right before I got on, you can look it up on YouTube. It's The Odd Couple Outtakes. It's about 8 or 9 minutes long, right. And Jack does a little introduction. So the executives were worried the show was too gay. And so I guess every week they'd get notes back. It's too gay. It's too gay, which it really isn't, but you know, homophobia. So they would throw in little clips of them being, of themselves being really gay. And they would, you know, dance around together and kiss. And there's one really funny one where Tony says to Jack, do you want to have some F-U-N? They would just send it over. I have no idea if they got the humor or not.
Did you ever get a sense, did he discuss this topic with you as well? Did he bring this up like as a remembrance as well that this happened?
Oh yes. He thought it was hilarious.
And did it last all five seasons, or was it at the beginning and once eventually they, you don't know if they.
No, because I think some of those outtakes are from later episodes.
Okay. All right.
I think they just always, you know, they just thought it was funny. Just wanted to rib the network executives.
And I think you are able to, at least to some degree, back up that the having Edward Villella and Martino Royo, who you've mentioned, I guess she's still around, and Richard Fredericks, that really was something that was a passion. Like Tony really wanted that to happen, right? Otherwise they wouldn't have been on the show.
I'm quite sure it was at least 95% Tony. Gary Marshall was also a big fan of performing arts and directed operas. And I don't
know.
He wrote and directed theater as well. Tony lived in New York, and the only time I'd see him get starstruck was with great performing artists. So Luciano Pavarotti or Domingo or the great ballet dancers, and Eddie Villella being one of them. So, and I think he felt like it was also his duty to bring these people on and teach people all over America about these great performing artists. And he also talked about how Johnny Carson did that and how important that was. So people learned more about opera and ballet and theater, et cetera. So he thought it was partly.
Yeah, what a huge platform that was at the time. Network television for a Marilyn Horne, for instance, who was a star of the New York, of the opera international stage, but probably never sang before more people than when she did Carmen on ABC network television prime time in 1973 or four.
But more than that, that's a sliver of what came after. The syndication runs.
Right. Then that
drown out. It's an avalanche compared to the how many people watched it once on ABC. Right. Yeah. But, you know, I never would have heard of those three people I just mentioned if it wasn't for The Odd Couple. And did those people stay, like, did you get to meet any of these? Did they stay around in Tony's world afterwards, like Eddie Villela? You call him Eddie, Martino Royo?
I think that's just because that's what Tony called him a couple times. Martino Royo lives on Central Park South, and she's an elegant, wonderful, sweet woman. You know, she was the first woman of color to star at the Met. I mean, a really, really super accomplished woman. And she says the thing she gets recognized for is The Odd Couple.
Yeah,
it makes sense because everybody knows The Odd Couple. Everybody's seen it. No, not that many people can come to New York or do come to New York to see opera.
What?
Yes, I know it's true. Some do. I'm saying compared to the amount of people who've seen the opera called television, the number of people come to New York to watch the opera is small.
Okay.
Now, one topic I want to mention, which I don't know if you know anything about, but it's one of Garrett's favorite topics, is the Odd Couple Sings record.
I love that record. It is so weird.
Well, one thing, I am a fan of that record existing. I won't say it's on my playlist.
But you made us play a clip of it on the podcast.
Absolutely. Yes. No, I thought it's fascinating. But one thing I always say when we get to a certain part of any episode, we say, of course, Felix is singing because Tony Randall loves to sing. Right?
So Tony and Jack did a Broadway production of The Sunshine Boys around 1998, and they used the soundtrack from that album as the opening and closing. So the song I really remember was Banana Peels.
Yes.
When Banana Peel starts sliding, I'll be coming back to you. I mean, and Jack can't really sing. And now he starred in Gypsy.
Right. I think what's funny that Tony, in his stage career, I believe he only did one musical Captain's Paradise.
Captain, and he did A Christmas Carol. He played Scrooge at Madison Square Garden.
Oh.
I Was Pregnant with Julia.
I see. So that was, that was later, right? Yeah.
Yeah, and with Ben Vereen, and he was the star, and it was spectacular. And he actually had to audition for that.
What? He did audition.
And I thought, he'd be really annoyed by that. And he said, no, they have to make sure I can sing. I mean, he was.
Right.
Oh, because of his age. Okay, that's fair.
Or something. Well, and it's a big, huge musical show. Right. No, he could pull it off.
Did he sing around?
Yeah, I guess, just to anticipate Ted's question, I also wanted to fit in about, we just noticed from the show, not only does he love to sing, but also old time radio. There's an episode of The Odd Couple with David Steinberg. I don't know if you watched that one.
I love David Steinberg.
Well, Dave, have you ever seen?
My favorite guest on Carson after me.
By the way, if you can help us get him on the podcast, I'll give you $50.
I've never met him. Sorry. Oh.
Well, the episode that David Steinberg did for The Odd Couple is really, really good one. And what stands out about it is that Felix on the show bonds with fictional David Steinberg about old time radio and old time radio songs. And I really felt, I don't know, David Steinberg was younger than Tony. He could have known some of those shows, but I just felt, wow, this is Leonard Rosenberg in Tulsa, Oklahoma in the 1930s, listening to the radio and never forgetting those songs. That's my theory.
You're absolutely right. He was obsessed with the old time Hollywood stars, as I mentioned, John Barrymore, especially John Barrymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he loved all that 1920s music. And in fact, I have some VHSs here of Tony performing on the Smothers Brothers and one other I'm not remembering, but he sang the song Lucky Lindy Up in the Sky. I mean, they're so funny. Yeah. He also had an album called Vovodio where he sang all those kind of
I've seen that. Yeah. Yeah. So that's right. He was able to record some albums and stuff. And I mean, it just seems like he took his, I don't know. He was really good. He was a really good singer.
Did he sing around the house? Did he sing musicals? Did he like sing in the shower or while he was getting ready?
He would do voice lessons every day.
Really?
He took his voice very, very seriously.
Wow. With a person there to help him or just on his own?
He used to go to someone and then in later years, he would just do it on his own. And then a friend of ours named Michael Mastro, a wonderful New York actor. We were all in a show together and Tony said, I want to give you lessons. So Michael would come over and Tony would teach him these vocal lessons. And our daughter, Julia, who was probably 3 at the time, she'd say, Mommy, Daddy, why do you and Michael yell at each other all the time?
Well, it's also like Felix giving Myrna lessons on how to speak as well. But he didn't like sing in the shower or sing Broadway tunes.
One, and he knows about Tony was obsessed with the Billy Flynn character in Chicago. Ooh. And
oh my God, he should have done that.
He wanted to.
Oh my God, that would have been, he could have still done that in the 90s, right?
I think I said, Tony, you should just let someone know you want to do it. I mean, it's like everybody and their mother has gone in that show.
Yeah, right.
It never felt.
So, and he would sing that around the house? Was that
yeah,
your point?
Yeah, he did really like that song.
I don't know if you're aware of this other controversy, Heather, in the Odd Couple role. It's not a debate, but maybe you're aware of this. So if you watch the episodes on streaming or on DVD, there are almost every musical segment is cut out because Paramount will not pay to get the rights to Cole Porter or whoever else they have to get. There are a few episodes that you can't do without the music rights. If you watch it on television, they're in there because the television rights were granted when the syndication deal was done. But one of the biggest complaints about the show, and most people are watching it on streaming, we also watch on DVDs, you don't hear most of the music. And I bet Tony would be furious today if he knew that
I'm
was
sure
happening.
He would.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, the Cole Porter stuff should be coming public domain soon.
So that's an interesting point that we actually would talk about the public domain issue when we got to those episodes. But I think Paramount would have to go back and re-put put them in, and maybe they will at some point because they just released a Blu-ray box set. But from what I read on the Facebook page or the reviews, it's the same musical cuts. It looks maybe better because it's a Blu-ray, but all the cuts in there. I don't think Paramount cares about this show the way we do. I mean, they got too many other shows to worry about, but it is a source of frustration to them. Yeah. All right, so I think we've covered as much as we can about The Odd Couple based on what you know and based on what our plan was. So let's go on a little bit to, so that show ends. Do you, actually, I will ask you this. I don't even ask you this. Do you remember, or did he ever share like, oh boy, I wish that show would, we could have gone on another 3 or 4 years, or did he feel like the time was right? Did he ever kind of share something like that with you?
I think he felt like it ran just the right amount of time.
Okay.
He felt like it was one of the greatest experiences of his life, and they were still great at the end and left on
went out on top. So, but then he quickly goes into another show. He gets, it does a 2-season show called The Tony Randall Show. And you did have some remembrances from him of what he felt about that. Is that right?
I think that was one of his least happy times. And I think he didn't get on with someone, but and it's not that I'm protecting that person. I can't remember if it was a producer or a writer, but I will tell you, Gary Goldberg, who
Family Ties. Yeah.
It was like his first job ever was in that show.
We played clips of that. So there's the TV Academy did an interview with him and he talked about the show. We played clips of that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he said Tony basically picked him. It seemed like to run the show after somebody else was fired or something.
And that might've been the person. But the thing he said, I think that was hardest is his name was on it.
Yeah.
And that put so much pressure on him. Mm-hmm. And I can understand that.
I can too. Yeah, I get that.
I always thought it was weird that his name was on it since his character wasn't even named Tony.
I know.
Walter Franklin. We watched that show for our podcast and it didn't hold. I remember watching it in the 90s. It was on in New York on a local station, I think in the afternoons on like CBS or something. And I really enjoyed it. And then we went back to watch it for our podcast. And
It was so ironic given that clearly the network packaged it as with his name to sell the show. But not only was the character not named Tony, but I watching it now, I had never seen it before. I was surprised how miscast he seemed oddly or not comfortable in the role. Like after it was a very big contrast to Felix in that it was someone who was very dignified and dignified in a different way, like in control and kind of normal. And he was kind of like the straight man in that show to a bunch of other
It's a little bit like characters. Like Bob Newhart. He was kind of like a Bob Newhart version of that.
And he just, I kept waiting for him to break out and do something really Tony-ish. So I could see how he could be frustrated. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I've only even seen one episode ever. So that he did not play that after dinner.
No.
Yeah.
One of my best friends I met because of that show, his name is Zane Lasky. He played Mario Lanza.
Oh, yes. Oh, okay. Yes. He was really good. Oh,
we noticed him. Yeah.
Okay. And then is that a coincidence or you?
No, because Zane was then in the National Actors Theater Company.
I see.
So we
met him. Oh, how okay. Nice. Yeah. All right. Yeah. He was one of the better parts of that show.
And Michael Keaton was a guest star. Young Michael.
Oh, yeah. Wow. In this last season, Walter starts teaching a night course. I think they're trying to do like a Welcome Back Cotter thing. And Michael Keaton shows up for 3 episodes. That was in LA, right? So he kept going to LA, I guess, for
yes.
All right, so the next project, at least television, then this will segue into National Actors Theater, and Garrett can lead our conversation there. Do you know any of the origin of how, not Love Sydney yet, but how Sydney Shore, Girl's Best Friend? Do you know anything behind how that came to be? Did he ever talk about that, or do you know anything about it?
So we lived in the same building as the woman that wrote that.
Ah, who was someone's daughter.
Yes.
You're blanking on who.
Well, everybody is somebody's, every woman is somebody's daughter, I have to say.
I want to say Eddie Cantor's daughter?
Yeah, maybe Eddie Cantor's daughter, Marilyn. Oh, shoot. Okay, we'll Google this.
You talk, Heather, and I'm going to
Ted does that.
Yeah, that's my job.
Yes, So she lived in her building. I don't know if that's how she got the script to him, but Tony was very close friends with another Eddie Cantor daughter. So it may have come that
It is
way.
Eddie Cantor, correct.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
And is her name Marilyn?
Marilyn Cantor Baker.
Yes, Marilyn Baker. So she probably got it to him through this her sister, another friend of Tony's named Edna McHugh. And I think that's one of the acting jobs he's most proud of in his career. Was the
Yes.
TV show television movie.
So she
One of the
wanted him to pull, sorry, she wanted him, she was targeting him. Like he didn't just,
probably.
okay, keep going. Sorry.
And you know, and it's a very poignant story. I
It
mean,
is,
we all know
yes.
these people in New York City. You know, these older gay men that may have, you know, not felt comfortable having a life partner or being out in any way, and they sort of live these quiet lives and listen to records and go to the opera. And I'm glad young people can be out and loud. But in Sidney Shore, in the television movie, he is a gay character, like out and out, he's gay. And so I get really mad when people say Ellen DeGeneres was the first out character on TV because it was Tony.
Yeah, that's a good point. Right. Yeah. So I we so we watched we did a Love Cindy episode, and I had neglected to watch the TV movie for our podcast. Garrett had, and then I went back to watch it, and I was so moved by it. I and then you're saying he's proud of it, and I understand why. He's just so perfect in it. And you know, people did think that Tony Randall was gay. I'm sure somebody still does. And he just played that
Or
role,
that Felix Unger was
or
gay.
Felix Unger was.
Yeah,
But I'm so glad that that he was proud of it, and that you know it had
I
that.
think it's a certain. It was the one role that he really showed his dramatic acting. So, glad he got to show that in a basically a full length film.
Yeah, and the set design of that apartment was so beautiful, and you felt it was all real.
Well, it was filmed on. It must have been filmed on location. I mean, I don't know about the apartment, but I mean the street scenes, the exteriors, you know.
Right. The
Of that
first year
neighborhood,
was
you
filmed in New York, and it was the only way he'd agree to do it.
know.
And then he
Well,
was really
that's Love Sydney.
Love
Oh,
Sydney.
right,
Oh,
which,
sorry.
yes,
Sydney.
yes, yeah. Yeah. So that movie airs, and then and you have you want to share your knowledge of how a Love Sydney sitcom came to be.
It was MTM and NBC, and Grant Tinker really wanted this to be a sitcom, and Tony didn't want to do it because he wanted to start his theater company. And Grant Tinker started just throwing money. And finally, Grant Tinker said, if you do this show, I'll establish a foundation in your name and put $1 million in it so you can start your theater. So that's why he agreed to do it. And then he had a foundation, and then he had something to build
So
on.
that really was the beginning of the National Actors Theater
It was, yes.
funding.
Do you want to address the gay thing? Because
Yes.
I just want to say I find it so interesting, especially in today's world where everybody's fluid and they
Yeah.
haven't committed to anything. As far as I know, Tony was completely heterosexual.
How would you know?
Exactly. But he was an actor. He was an artist, and he thought nothing of playing effeminate roles or gay roles or out roles. And he hosted the AIDS Walk in New York City every single year from the year it started to the year he passed. And it never occurred to him to protect himself in any way. He was an artist, and you play all kinds of people. And he didn't, but I also never heard him express like anger about it. I think I would probably get
Right.
angrier than other people, but
About being,
about people
yeah.
saying he's gay, you
Right,
know.
right,
Never really
right.
heard him
People
express.
and people like projecting that onto his private life. Yeah.
Exactly. It's like,
Right.
oh, well, why?
Yeah.
Why is
Did
this
he?
happening?
Well, I think, you know, it's just, well, what stands out about him, I think, in his whole career is that he's, you know, he's developing, he's putting out there. Well, Felix, look at Felix Unger. I mean, now, funny enough, like the character Felix Unger is in some circles kind of a gay icon as just the character of his opera love, his the way he dresses, whatever. And that, you know, styles change and that kind of like it attracts now maybe more of a gay aesthetic. But I do think Felix Unger is a kind of not necessarily fluid sexuality, but a different kind of masculinity. He is an opera loving snob who dresses very flashily, but is also dating women and is in love with his ex-wife. And so, and is a great father.
And he's like a cook and he's neat. He's got other things.
He breaks down.
Who wouldn't want to date this guy?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right, yeah. Right, well, except he's a little crazy. I mean, Gloria did not want to date him at some point.
Yes. Yeah. He would be a lot.
So I think there's, I mean, I also come from an academic background, so I think the character of Felix Unger as played by Johnny Randall is a great study in gender, identity of that, especially the 70s.
Yeah. Around the time he was dying, or maybe right after, the New York Times did a little profile on him and they called him the first metrosexual.
That's really makes sense. Yeah. By the way, $1 million in 1979 was $4.3 million today.
Wow.
For his foundation. So before we get to a little more, this seems like a good place to say that you had a story about him being mean to a reporter because they kept asking him if he was like Felix. Can you share that?
And I think he would be occasionally. I just remember being in a green room and Jack was there and they were doing some kind of appearance. I can't remember what it was, but we're all back in the green room and this young junior reporter from People magazine, I mean, she's probably 25. She says, so are you really like Felix? Are you really like Oscar? Mm-hmm. And Tony ripped into this poor girl. Oh, gee, that's so original. No one ever thought to ask her question before. And he was just yelling at her. And finally, Jack said, Tony, calm down, stop. He just went off on this poor girl.
And you were there. I was mortified.
You?
Oh my God.
I mean, not that I'm always well behaved, but I was mortified in that moment.
Oh, that's right. So he just was annoyed. But did he not think he was? I mean, forget the fact of the question.
I just think he had no patience for it.
Right,
he just,
yeah.
You know.
Well, it's like what you said about the musical theme. It's like he's been asked that question. He was asked that question for 30 odd years, right?
You know, I also have another funny story that it's very sweet. So he was doing a Broadway show and I was home with the kids, the babies at the time. And so I wasn't there all the time. And so one night he came home and he looked really ashamed. I said, what's wrong, Tony? And he said, well, I walked out of the stage door and I was signing autographs. And this one kid kept asking me for my autograph. And I finally told him to shove it up his ass.
A kid?
Well, I could tell he was an autograph collector and he was going to sell it. You know, he was selling autographs. I could tell. And I said, Tony, I can't believe you spoke that way. Because he was very, very polite in public. I mean, he really was like well-trained by the studio system to behave himself in public. And so he was so ashamed. It's kind of funny. So when Tony died in 2004, and there were online forums at that point, and people were writing, oh, I met him once in Zabar's and he was so nice. I met him on the street. He was so nice. I saw him on the subway. He was so nice. And then one person wrote, he told me to shove it up my ass.
There. Be careful who you.
Yeah.
How well, you treat you?
So before we get to National Actors Theater, the idea that Sidney Shore, a TV movie, a very poignant movie, would be a sitcom still shocks me today when I watch that TV movie. Now, you know, I Mary Tyler Moore, Lou Grant was a drama out of Mary Tyler Moore. I understand that a little bit. Did he, the money aside, I don't, maybe he never shared this level of detail with you, or maybe just your observing of those shows, did it seem bizarre to you that they did a sitcom out of that? Or am I wrong?
Actually, Love, Sidney is really the first time I was aware of Tony Randall, and I loved that show. And the reason I loved it was his relationship with the little girl.
Yeah, Queen of Kiff. Yeah, right. It is really good. Yeah,
so it's sort of funny. I think he really loved the TV movie, and the sitcom was a really good payday.
Yeah. So right, got it.
He was always going to work his bum off to put out the best possible product.
So, and you shared an interesting tidbit with me about his salary and who he beat out as the highest paid actor that year, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah. For one season, he was the highest paid actor on TV, and he had beaten out Carol O'Connor.
Who was doing Archie Bunker's place? Because that's because is it just because of the salary, but also because of the endowment? Do you or do you not know
No, I
that?
think it was the
I'll show
salary.
yourself that that's fascinating.
You
That
know, I think it's hilarious now when, you know, when the Friends and they were all getting a million episode, or Kelsey Grammer, you know, made $100 million from Frasier. It's like it was nothing like that.
But at the
Nothing like
time
that.
it was very good. Okay, so Gary, you want to lead a
Yeah,
conversation?
well, this is a good segue because I knew it took a long time for him to get the National Actors Theater together, but I didn't
Sorry, can
realize
you
this.
explain for everybody what
Yeah.
the National
Okay.
Actors Theater
Oh,
is?
well,
One of
let's
you, one of you.
let
Let
Heather. Heather,
Heather do that.
explain.
What is it? Like, what was it? What was it for? Before you get into like the origins of the storytelling, can you just give a summary?
Sure. Tony started out in the theater. He was a trained classical actor. All he really wanted to do was the classics on Broadway. And then TV and movies took him out to Hollywood, and he had this fantastic career. And as he got older, he said, "I've made enough money. I want to make this theater. We don't have this tradition in America like they do in England and France and Israel and all of these places. And we need a national theater where great actors can play great roles." And so he went to all these great actors. Martin Sheen was the first star there. He was in The Crucible. And George C. Scott did Inherit the Wind. Maximilian Schell did Judgment at Nuremberg. And it really, he in some ways really did achieve it. It was a tough, tough road to hoe, though. It was constant fundraising, and the critics were really tough on him. They were really awful, actually. But it was a noble, it was a very noble endeavor. It was his life's passion, and he succeeded in getting it on. He was on Broadway for 10 years with that.
It, a lot of shows. As I mentioned, I was a subscriber to, well, the first one I saw was the fundraiser, was the special, the Odd Couple
Did
benefit
you
for
go in
fundraisers.
person?
I did, because
Oh my gosh, I'm so jealous.
my good friend Tony at the time talked his mom into making the donation so that we could go see it. And it's funny, we had a fellow fan on the show named Lee who was also there, so he and I got to reminisce about that performance. It was amazing to see as just a fan of the show. And that was an all-star cast. Martin Sheen was, he got a bunch of actors to play the supporting character, the poker players. Martin Sheen, Jack Weston, Cleavon Little, and Abe Vigoda
Abe
were the poker players.
Vigoda.
And then the Pigeon Sisters were, I believe, Kate Nelligan and Kate Burton. Or maybe
No,
not Kate
Kate
Burton. It was,
Nelligan and
and
Joanna Gleason.
Joanna Gleason,
And
right.
the only
Two.
reason I know that
Yep.
is for anyone that lives in New York, you can go to the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center,
Yes.
and they film all of the Broadway shows, so you can see filmed performances, and
Yep.
that's there. And
They
I went
have that one?
last
Oh
week.
wow.
Yes,
Oh great.
and
Oh
it's
wow. Well,
wonderful.
now the fans will they storm the gates there.
The
Watch out. Anyway, it was wonderful. And then I think the first season I was away, but I remember the first production I saw there was Time in Athens.
Oh, that was about 3 or 4 seasons in.
Right. Okay. So then I subscribed to that season with Time in Athens and Government Inspector and
Right.
Flowering Peach with Eli Wallach.
That was Eli and Anne. Yeah.
So that's nice that even though they had a reunion there. And then throughout the following years, I saw a bunch of, I saw, I did, I wish I saw Three Men on a Horse. I was away for that. I remember that going on. I saw them in the Sunshine Boys, which was amazing. And I saw Judgment at Nuremberg, and I
Oh, I was
saw,
in
so
that.
you were, oh,
I was the Judy Garland role.
there you go. Oh
Judy
my
Garland.
God.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, I saw a bunch of, I want to get to some of the later ones I saw too. I must say, well, while I might mention Sunshine Boys, in Sunshine Boys, I thought he was so hilarious. I mean, his Tony specifically, because he was playing a totally different character. He was playing the quiet old man,
Yeah,
and he really
crotchety.
was, I felt, embracing like the old Jew in him, as kind of the makeup and the gait, and he just had this whole character which was so something from a different world as Felix. And and this deadpan quality, the story that Jack tells about, I think there's a clip of it online of Tony stirring his tea and like this long, endless pause that cracked the audience up every night. So I thought that was a role where he was already in his 70s, I think, and he was so great in that role. It was just a delight to see him. I remember, but just the only thing I was going to add about the beginnings of the Actors Theater is that, yes, if you look online for videos of Tony Randall on YouTube, which I'm sure you have, it's like more than 50% of them are him going on talk shows in the late 80s and early 90s, you know, promoting and plugging the National Actors Theater. And it's what I admire so much is the hustle that he showed. Like, once he determined to do that, then they told him, okay, this is how you do it. You got to raise X million dollars, because he was basically creating a nonprofit company to operate on Broadway, which was kind of unprecedented at that time. It's very difficult. Now there are a few that make it work, but at that time, that was very not a lot of encouragement to do that. Basically, most people produce, for people listening out there, people, you know, well, you produce on Broadway on a commercial show by show model, but to create a permanent company committing to doing three or so productions a year in a Broadway theater, but on a non-profit contract, means you have to have a lot in reserve, a lot of donations. You have to have a lot of donors, a lot of endowment.
Absolutely. And the Odd Couple benefit performance, I think, raised $1 million, and he had that $1 million, and he had a big angel donor who gave several $1 million, and then he would just hustle and hustle and hustle.
Yeah, and the Eagle Snacks commercials.
And I remember he had no compunction about it too. I remember there's a wonderful philanthropist in New York named Jonathan Tisch. And whenever we'd see him, Tony would say, "Can I have a CONTRIBUTION? And I'd say, I'd say to Jonathan, "Are you okay?" And he'd go, "Of course, you know, you have to do this." Yeah. And then once we were on, maybe on The View, I can't remember, but he went up to Whoopi Goldberg and he said, "Can you perform in my benefit gala this year?" And she said, "Oh," you know, she begged out in some way. And I said, I said to her later, I said, "I'm sorry, that was really aggressive." She said, "No, you have to. It's exactly what you have to do. No problem. No problem."
Yeah. Right. He did it. And I'm sure, you know, that's not how he saw himself maybe initially doing it, but he was good at it. And he wished it into being, and it wasn't an amazing achievement, but it's amazing. It really did take him 10 years to even to start with an idea and the first fundraising to the first production. I will say one of the times I met him was I was working in a Broadway producer's office in the summer of 1989. It was kind of an internship, summer job. And my boss was producing M. Butterfly,
which I saw. I saw him in that.
So you—that's right. You saw. Now I had not. Unfortunately, I never saw him in it because I was back to college. But he, in the summer, is when they needed a replacement for John Lithgow, and he came into the office to meet with the producers, and it's amazing. That was a very demanding role, and in a play that became a big hit, but was kind of, you know, it's talking about like not worrying about any rumors about his sexuality, but it's about a man who falls in love with another man thinking he's a woman, and a very demanding role for him to take on. But I imagine not only it's a great role, why wouldn't he want to do it, but I know that he was also using that to raise money. I mean, his salary from that was going to the Actors Theater probably.
Well, it probably was, but he did that role because he wanted to do that really badly. And it was one of the things he would say he was the most proud of.
It was his return to the stage too. I mean, that was actually his first return, his first real big, he had not been appearing on stage for ever since The Odd Couple, I think. So.
Yeah. Well, he was, but it was
overseas. Right. And in London.
He went up to Halifax to work with John Neville at his theater, and he played a lot of great roles. And he also did lots and lots of those big, huge summer theaters like the Muni in St. Louis. Oh. And He'd play Around the World in 80 Days and The Music Man and all those kinds.
Oh, so he did more musicals, yeah.
Yeah, he did.
I'm sorry. Yeah, Butterfly was his Broadway, right? His return to Broadway. And in a way that did, as I remembered at the time, that kind of helped raise the consciousness of the National Actors here, because he would say, he'd go on interviews on TV shows and he'd be plugging that. It was 1989, so that was already like already underway.
And I, you know, now you're reminding me with the Eagles chips, I think Anheuser-Busch owned that. And I think they also gave a lot of money to the theater.
Right. Good, good really hustling.
About 1980 to the end of his life was, he took jobs for various reasons, but his focus, his real passion was getting this theater going.
Yeah. It's almost as if like he did the Love Sydney and he was willing to say goodbye to television at that point. To devote the time to this. Amazing. The other thing about the National Actors Theater I want to say is that I also saw one of his last performances in what was probably the most ambitious show you guys did, which is Arturo Uy.
It was incredible.
Now that, Ted, I don't know if you remember that. We're following this Tony Randall's theatrical exploits then.
Nope.
This would have been early 2000s, 2001,
2002.
Yep. Al Pacino starring in a Bertolt Brecht play that was almost never revived. It was this huge all-star cast where Pacino was the main star, but it also had John Goodman, Billy Crudup, Chaz Palminteri, Steve Buscemi, right. Paul Giamatti, who was not as famous then.
Oh, and you know who was in it that was unknown? And I only realized this recently looking at a program, Sterling K. Brown.
Oh, wow. He was on This Is Us. I don't know if Garrett knows that.
No, I don't.
Garrett does not. I handle the TV on the podcast.
Any television after the office.
Yeah, Heather, I handle TV. Garrett Howland's place.
Right. Oh, and speaking of actors that nobody knew anything was going to happen with them, and then they became stars, he did a revival of Inherit the Wind with George C. Scott and Charles Durning, and the little boy in the play, and I only knew this, learned this a couple years ago, was Paul Dano.
Oh, wow. Yeah, he was a child actor, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. The thing I want to say about Arturo, and it was directed by the great Simon McBurney, who's, Tony's recruited, sometimes got these great directors to come in and do this, because who else would put this play on? And McBurney put on this incredibly epic film projections, rotating stages, like the whole deal. And I was flabbergasted. I just was completely overwhelmed by it. I thought it was fabulous. I just felt, wow, this, you know, because it wasn't at all a conventional Broadway production. In a way, he was showing how if you put the money and resources behind it, you can just do these really creative things that bring together all these world-class artists. You can see, like, a lot of those actors did not do a lot of theater, like Buscemi and Palminteri.
Buscemi started out in Downtown.
Oh, in the Wister Group. I know he was with the Wister Group.
Oh, yeah, you know everything. I can't get anything over on you.
Sorry, you go ahead. Well, he doesn't, it's not like he returns. It's not like he does Broadway, you know, Buscemi. I mean, he clearly was doing this. I think a lot of them were doing
it. He was going to do the three. So I was the president of the board of New York Theater Workshop for 10 years. I was on the board 18 years. He was going to do a production of The Three Sisters there, but then the pandemic happened.
I see. Well, okay. Another time I'd love to hear more of the things that could have been that weren't. I just had the feeling a lot of people wanted to be in the show to be with Pacino, and it was such a special event. Yeah.
So what happened was, it's so bizarre because Tony and Al knew each other from like the 70s. And I think Tony had seen Al in something before he was a huge star. And he thought, oh my God, this kid is amazing. And maybe it was Panic in Needle Park. I'm not sure the movie. But anyway, he wanted to do the Zoo Story with Al. Mm. And so Al was a young, street guy kind of guy. And so they were going to do that, and then they couldn't align their schedules, and then Al became Al.
I see.
And so they talked about it for years.
Yeah.
And they did a reading at the neighborhood playhouse. They were going to see if maybe they could do it now, you know, as much older
than. That would have been fun, yeah.
And then somehow Arturo Uy came up. Al Pacino likes to do the same role over and over, which I think he's done Salome many times, Richard III many times, Arturo Uy. So we wanted to tackle that again. And I really thought Al was going to break Tony's heart and say no in the end. Mm. I think Al responded to Tony's passion about the theater.
Yeah.
Yes. And then Simon McBurney said yes. And then all these actors called up and asked to be in it.
Oh, wow. Amazing. Yeah. They heard about it and they want in on that, right? Yeah. Because it's a it had a cast of like over 20 or 30 or so. And I've never seen like a cast list that deep of like known great actors.
Incredible.
And including, I don't want to leave out to me, one of the star performers was Tony Randall.
Yes.
Now that scene, okay, there's a scene in the play, Ted, where Arturo Uy is an allegory of Hitler's rise to power, told as a gangster story. And so a lot of the scenes are kind of modeled on things Hitler actually did. And it's true that they say Hitler developed his speaking style being coached by various like theatrical coaches. And so there's a scene where Arturo, the Pacino character, goes to visit an old actor to learn how to give better speeches. And the way McBurney directed it and said it was just, there's a picture of it somewhere. I'm going to find it. I'm going to post it on our site if I can. I don't know if you have it, Heather, but Tony's makeup, Tony completely, he completely committed. Now he was already close to 80, I think, when the
show. Mm-hmm.
The actor is supposed to be like a corpse already. He's like an old ham actor. And you see him there with a huge beard. He's almost unrecognizable. He's sitting there with a glass of vodka. He's basically like completely passed out. But then he kind of finds his strength as he demonstrates how to give the speech to Pacino. And it was I could tell he was having so much fun to do it because he's a ham actor. And I was as Felix, I could see Tony loves to ham it up, like yes. laughs, you know? And it was just so perfect. And I just was wonderful how I don't know if he envisioned himself in the role all along, but McBurney seemed to really, capitalize on having him in the role. And it was, even if Tony Randall was not producing the show, it would have been just a great casting coup to have him in. And that's my fondest memory of the whole National Actors Theater.
That's really sweet. So that was toward the end of Tony's life.
Yes.
And he wasn't well. And Simon called me one day and he said, Heather, you have to talk Tony out of doing this play. He's not in wow. shape to go on stage. And he kind of went on, he's sleeping in the wings, when we're rehearsing and all these things. And I said, Simon, have you ever met a star? And trust me, when you push him out on the stage, he will do it. And he was very tired. He was really struggling at that point in his life. He only lived about 2 years after that. And he'd sort of be this, exhausted person in the wings, and then he'd go out on stage and be the great Tony Randall.
He probably wouldn't have had it any other. I mean, he'd rather do that than come home and rest up, I assume, right?
I think he would have been happy to die on the stage.
Yeah. Yes.
Right. So the interesting time, I want to just
yes.
move on a little bit to, and you were sharing, so I think one of the things younger people, they may not be young today, but younger people in the 90s think of Tony as he made many appearances on David Letterman.
Yes.
And you,
right now
you,
to end on, yeah.
you said that he did that to keep his self in the famous. And maybe and also maybe for the Actors Theater too, or no?
What he always said was, I live 20 blocks away, and they would call him if someone canceled, and he could get right down there to the theater and, slap some makeup, and he could go on and do anything. And then he would do the sketches and all of that. And he was just a great sport. he was also very practical. Talk show guests have to be paid whatever the day rate is. And it was about $160 at the time. And they'd pick him up in a car, and I'd often go with him, and he'd say, well, it keeps me famous. We get a car for the night, and it'll pay for dinner at Le Cirque. It's very, very practical.
I love that. I love that can you quickly share your story about, so Tony was not a cheap person, but he didn't enjoy spending money when it didn't need to. Can you share the telephone number story that you told me?
Oh, yes, yes. So it cost extra money, let's say $1 a month, to have your number private. So, and he didn't want to pay the dollar, $10, whatever it was, to have his number listed private. So he registered himself under the name Irving Pisher.
Isn't that a great story?
I think that name comes from some, it's like a old movie director or something. You know. Anyway.
And then
I wanted to, can I tell you the Walk of Fame story?
Yes.
Is that what you were gonna ask?
Yes.
Okay. So Tony does not have a star on the Walk of Fame. And the reason is because I guess they come to you and say, would you like a star on the Walk of Fame? And you say yes. And then you have to pay $10,000. It may be more now, but at the time it was $10,000. And Tony said, why do I need to spend $10,000 to walk on me on Mollywood Boulevard?
It's not even in New York. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So no point in it.
So as much as he had an ego, I think the use of money trumped the ego.
Tony's ego was about being a good actor.
Yeah.
It wasn't so much about accolades. Or money. Yeah.
And then, so I think we can't leave without addressing that Tony and Jack after the show, I think you told me they were like friendly on the show, but not friends, but that friendship really developed later. And you were part of that, especially as he got throat cancer and really nursed him or encouraged him to get back on stage.
Yes.
You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yes. So they always had tremendous respect for each other. And he said they would argue on The Odd Couple, but it was always about the work. It was never about ego. It's never about the dressing room or anything like that. It was just about making the work better. And they respected each other, but they weren't friends. Jack lived in California. Tony lived in New York, you know, different lives going on. And I think it was around the time of that benefit performance of The Odd Couple in 91 that they started to get a lot closer. And then right after Tony and I got married, they did The Odd Couple in London. Jack's wife, Peggy, was there, of course. And we didn't necessarily know that many people in London. And so we started saying, well, let's have dinner together. And Peggy really pushed that a lot. And then Peggy and I became close. And then we would hang out. And then we would get the guys to be together. And they formed a really, really beautiful, poignant friendship at the end of their lives.
And
Jack comes across on the screen. Ted and I have talked about this so much, about Jack Klugman's appeal. As Oscar and in all his career, is just such a warm presence. And it's interesting. It's clear from the way that you and others have talked about him that he really had that warmth in person.
He was a good person. I mean, that was a good generation of people. He went through a lot.
And he was there with you and Tony when Tony was ill, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. And he spoke at Tony's funeral and... Oh, speaking of funerals, I know this is a bit of a left turn.
Please.
But I really wanted to talk about Gary Marshall's memorial.
Okay.
Because I've never been to such a good memorial in my life. So it was he had so many people there that they had to do it at the auditorium at Cal State Irvine. Mm-hmm. And you'd go and you'd go, oh my God, there's Richard Gere. Oh my God, there's Dick. Oh my God. Julia Roberts spoke. Tom Hanks spoke. Henry Winkler spoke. Bette Midler sang Wind Beneath My Wings. Bryan Adams sang something from Pretty Woman. And then the whole thing ended with the Northwestern Marching Band.
Oh, wow.
Literally, when I've never been to such a good memorial in my life.
Yeah, epic. Wow. Well, it just again shows how loved he was in the industry.
I assume Tony's funeral was fairly still also impressive and had a lot of poignancy to it.
Yeah. Jack spoke and Eli Wallach spoke and Cheryl Milnes, the opera singer, spoke. And everyone was there. Not really something I like to remember.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Okay.
It's okay. Back to play. he was very loved and lots of people were there. Actually, Rudy Giuliani came to speak.
Because he married you.
Is that true? He married you guys.
Yes. And David Dinkins was invited, the mayor before him. He's such a lovely gentleman. And they hated each other. And I was sort of seated between them and I could feel the hate. And I hadn't asked David Dinkins to speak, only Giuliani. And so David had shown up with a speech. Oh. And so then I asked him to speak at the memorial, which was a Broadway memorial. And he spoke very, very poignantly about him.
Just like New York royalty shows up, you know, for Tony.
When Tony literally...
He was an ambassador for New York officially.
When people were running for mayor, they would call him and ask him for an endorsement.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
I always thought that was incredible.
That is.
Well, it's funny. One of the Odd Couple episodes is that became relevant because there's an episode where Oscar is down on New York and Felix needs to convince him to be a proud New Yorker again, show him that New York is not so bad. You know, Oscar's making fun of the crime and all that. And they ended up on the subway, and it's called the subway episode. And when we looked into that episode, it was a very, we rarely get a clear statement about what was the purpose of the episode. That Tony, at that time, 74 or so, is like an official ambassador for New York, like part of the I Love New York campaign or something, I don't know. And he said, you know, let's do something on the show to celebrate New York. And it seems like that really lasted, you know, for the mayors of New York to pay attention to him. Yeah. And he was bringing, and I can imagine, like, when you are running a big nonprofit company like the National Actors Theater and part of the entertainment theater industry in New York, like, you're a player, you're part of the, everyone knows you, he's fundraising, you know, getting grants, government grants. It's like he really was, had to make connections in the highest levels.
Yeah. Well, and Tony was really a fabric of New York. We lived on the Upper West Side. He lived on the Upper West Side forever. You could see him in Fairway. You could see him in Zabar's. He took the subway. He took the bus. You know, he was, I remember when we were first dating, I was really young. We were walking past a construction site and I thought, oh God, they're going to say something rude to me. And we get closer and they're like, Tony Randall.
Yeah,
like a New York fantasy. Yeah,
you know, Gara and I both grew up in New York. I grew up in the city. I live four blocks from 1049 Park Avenue. And, you know, as somebody grew up in the 70s and 80s, though, he really was one of those true New York icons that just, he was New York. There's so much about him that represented the best of the city. And seeing him, I walked by him once on the street, and it was just, you know, it just, he celebrates so much of what the city is about, and you know, he truly was clearly more than just Felix. You know, he just had so many, as we've talked about now for 2 hours, and we're going to let you go momentarily.
We can talk for 4 hours.
You can, which is why I'm so happy to hear that you are trying to think about getting a documentary, because he really should be celebrated.
Okay, and people will have turned off by now, I'm sure, because they're sick of me, but you made me go to his archives.
Yes.
And you're going to help me, Ted.
Yes, I can't wait to do that. Oh, that's fantastic.
I'll show
that's
you.
That's a tie. That's a tie. Okay.
Yes, a tie. He's only up a black and white tie.
That looks like it could have been on the Odd Couple, right?
Yes.
It was. I saw the episode the other day.
Oh, okay. Now I really want to see that and match that up. That's fantastic.
Heather, is there anything more that I want to just give a chance to learn more about Heather, because I know that after Tony passed, and I assume like you presided, you had to, the company ended, National Actors Theater, effectively, I believe, right?
About a year after he died, we told him.
Yeah, and but you then started, I think, a philanthropic venture of your own or something. I remember in the theater world, you were active in grants and funding for theater.
Yes, he left a foundation, which kind of gave me the route to be more involved in civic work around the theater. I was the board president of New York Theater Workshop for many years. It was a really wonderful experience for me. I needed to move on from widowhood and being out of Tony's, you know, get out of Tony's shadow. And I had an amazing time there in the East Village. We produced Peter and the Star Catcher, Once, Hades Town, Slave Play. And before my time, they had produced Rent and many Tony Kushner plays and Carol Churchill plays. And it was a fantastic thing to do.
And now are you talk about your dream of a Tony documentary. Is that something, anything else, something you want to talk about that you're planning?
Well, that's my focus right now. I've done other philanthropic work. I've worked with kids in Rwanda. I do a scholarship program for teenage girls in Rwanda, which is totally different than theater.
Yes, right.
But no, the documentary is my kids, they're in their mid-20s. They live in Brooklyn with artists. So there's lots of supporting.
One thing I recall about when I read about you guys having a family is that I believe both your children have very unique middle names.
Yes. Jefferson is, his name is Jefferson Salvini Randall. Jefferson is Joseph Jefferson, the great 19th century comedian who played Rip Van Winkle. And Salvini is for Tommaso Salvini, who played Otello on the Italian stage.
And was Stanislavski's favorite actor.
Oh my gosh. Fountain of knowledge. And then Julia is Julia for his mother, and Lorette is her middle name for Lorette Taylor, who was his favorite actress. Yeah,
so steeped in their names are steeped in theater history. I hope they don't feel condemned to a life in the theater.
No, but Tony used to look at when Jefferson was a little boy, Tony would look at him and he'd say, oh God, I hope he doesn't become an accountant. Right.
Well, I'm sure if somehow they are led by genetics or whatever into the performing arts, they will do great. I always thought that was very charming detail. I feel like one of the, you know, 1% of people who would recognize the name Salvini.
Salvini. Well, and then there's that right wing guy in Italy, which didn't help.
Never mind.
Yes, they are named for, and they are having a good time down there in Brooklyn, being actors, writers, producers,
great
niggers, everything.
So the legacy lives on. Well, we could talk another 2 hours, but we're going to allow you to have some life back. And this has been a delight. We are so excited and thrilled that you reached out to us, and we're going to stay in touch and help you out whatever you need in whatever you are going to continue to do. And we just can't thank you enough for spending this much time with us and for reaching out to you.
Yes, thank you so much.
You know, the podcast was my idea. And the fact that we're now talking to you and that you like the show made all of it worth it.
Absolutely.
Me personally, I'm sure Garrett would agree, but when I was thinking about it, the fact that we're here now talking to you, it's like I couldn't imagine that actually would happen. The fact it's happening is a thrill, I think, for me, and I guarantee nobody speaks for you. So thank you so much.
It's my pleasure, and it's so fun to talk about his work. And I don't talk about him often in public. And you guys are just so dedicated to the show, and I knew you'd be really sweet, and it wouldn't get like gossipy and weird.
No, definitely not. We thank you
when I bring it in.
Right. Yeah. We'll let you handle that. Thank you for trusting us with that. And hopefully we'll stay in touch and talk to you soon.
Yeah. And thank you for doing this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tell everyone.
Yeah. Everyone, right.
Anyone who's, I mean, right now, I actually think our podcast is as good a coverage of Tony Randall's career as is out there, actually, given that what we talk about constantly his whole career outside of the episode. So if you want to learn more about Tony Randall, you can certainly start by listening to 1049.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I'll post it on my Instagram, which has a solid 500 followers.
500 good followers. That's influencers, I am sure.
Thank you, Heather.
Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.